Hi, Kate O'Toole here. Welcome to the guest room at ABC Local Online. I hope you enjoy this download. And don't forget, you can hear the guest room live each weekday from 11am on 105.7 ABC Darwin and 783 ABC Alice Springs.
If you've been reading picture books to kids over the last 25 years or so, you may have come across some of these characters. Clive, who eats alligators, Noni the pony, Spider Sipping Rosie, and Ernie, who dances to the didgeridoo. They're all creations of Alison Lester, one of our best-loved children's book authors and illustrators. Alison's adventures have taken her across Australia, working in remote Aboriginal communities, including Gunbalanya in the Territory, and also to Antarctica. This week, Alison Lester is visiting schools and libraries in the Territory and is spending the next hour with you in the guest room. And this is her first musical selection, probably not what you're expecting from one of Australia's best known children's authors. Wow, Alison Lester. I was not expecting Prisoner of Society, The Living End to be one of your musical selections, but there you go.
Oh, thanks, Kate, and thanks for having me here too.
What is it that just got you about that particular song?
I just love the energy of it, and I am someone who doesn't like being told what to do. I was always in trouble at school, but it always brings back very strong memories. My daughter Claire and I used to love lying in bed on Saturday mornings on rainy days watching Rage, and I remember when we first saw and heard that song, it was like, wow, this song's from Melbourne. It seemed an incredibly just wowy song to come from where we lived, yeah.
And spoke to you. Don't tell me what to do. Yeah. You actually went up to the band at Sydney Airport once, didn't you?
Yeah, a few years ago I was going through the airport and I saw them and I just couldn't help myself and I went up and I said, look, I'm kind of embarrassed because I know I'm not really your demographic, but I really love your music. And I saw you live once at the Hallam Hotel, and was that double bass player I was talking to who said, wow, that was a really long time ago.
There you go. It's good to be able to voice these things. You are a very busy lady. You're in the Territory this week visiting schools and doing sessions at libraries. But you've also just released a book that you wrote and illustrated with Coral Tullock called One Small Island. Can you tell me about this book?
Yeah, it was just launched in Hobart the weekend before last. And it's a book about Macquarie Island, because Macquarie Island is an incredibly beautiful place deep in the Southern Ocean, like halfway between New Zealand and Antarctica. It was only discovered in 1810, so it must have been one of the last places discovered by man. And there's no evidence that anyone had lived there. The sealers who found it described a wreck of ancient design high above the high watermark. But the wood from that boat would have been burnt many years ago because there's no trees on the island, so there's no evidence of it there. And they must have found just paradise, like this place just swarming with animals. Because the island is the only landfall for thousands of miles, it's where all the mammals from the Southern Ocean come to breed and all the birds. So it really is where they come to rest and have their babies.
And what sort of landscape does it have?
It's an incredible place. It was formed when two big plates from, you know, under the ground pushed together and pushed a chunk of the ocean floor upwards. So it's I think it's about 35 kilometres long, a long skinny island with a flat top. And that flat top is what has given it its World Heritage status, is because it's one of the only places in the world where you can study the ocean floor well above the ocean floor. But within 10 years, in those days, sealing was one of the only products that was really coming out of Southern Australia. And the sealers went down there with a vengeance. And within 10 years, the fur seals had been hunted to the brink of extinction. I think they probably killed more than 200,000 even for those times, an incredibly wasteful, you know, dreadful way of doing it. But the oil industry was a really big thing. There was oil used for lamps and harness and all sorts of things. So they stayed down there and they hunted elephant seals and penguins, boiled them up for their oil. And as they did it, as they were depleting the local population, they also introduced rabbits as a food source for the sealers. Often the sealing boats would be a long time getting back, so the men would be starving. And what seemed like a good idea at the time, hundreds of years later, was really the very worst thing that could happen for the island, because a few years ago it was almost completely chewed out, like all the shelter for the birds was gone because the rabbits were just devouring it. But luckily this year they've, due to the hard work of a lot of people, they've had a program that probably cost about $25 million where they've dropped poison baits from the sky, released yet another rabbit virus, and the rabbits are almost gone. The cats had been eliminated a few years ago, and there'll be people staying there with guns and dogs to mop up the remaining rabbits. But within a few years, they think that all the introduced animals will be gone. So that's a very long way of saying what this book's about.
But what's your connection with this place?
I visited it first when I had an Antarctic Arts Fellowship in 2005, and went on a 6-week resupply voyage to Mawson in Antarctica and back to Casey. And then we stopped at Macquarie Island on the way back, and I visited it then and was expecting all this lush mega herbs and tussocks, and instead saw this island that looked terrible. You know, it was all eroded and all the grass was short, and someone said, "Oh, didn't you know about the rabbits?" And I went, "No, I didn't."
Was it that first trip where that part of the world really got under your skin?
I just loved it. I'm so addicted to Antarctica. I spend a whole lot of my time trying to figure out how to get back there.
Plotting and planning.
Can I get a job on this ship or can I do that? And I have gone back a few times. But that very first trip, even just the Southern Ocean blew me away, like just being out for 2 weeks on this huge sea where occasionally it was still, but it was nearly always just huge seas, you know, and the ship would be rocking and rolling, and you had to kind of ride it like a horse, you know, you always had to hang on to something and kind of brace your legs and go with the swells. Always incredible bird life flying behind the boat to pick up whatever, you know, the propellers were stirring up. And then once you got into the icebergs, it was like, wow, there's, you know, just, I mean, people write about it all the time. It's mind-blowing, like going to another planet.
And what was the job of the boat? You're on a resupply boat.
Yeah, it was the Aurora Australis, the P&O boat that the Antarctic Division used for all their resupplies. I think they're about to look for a new one now because it's getting quite old. And I have been down since on tourist boats, and they're fabulous as well. But I did love going on a working ship where everyone who was going had a purpose. You know, there were coxswains going to drive the dinghies that took people ashore, and crane operators, and people who were going down to actually live at Mawson for a year and do research down there.
For somebody who loves to illustrate and to imagine the natural world, your senses must go into overdrive when you go into a place like this for the first time.
I was overexcited the whole time. Like, I was just...
What do you do when you're overexcited?
Well, I wake up really early and I go to bed really late, and I'm just kind of doing stuff all the time. Talk like my lacquer bands are wound up very tight. But I remember when I headed off, a couple of people said to me, "What are you going to draw? Everything will be white." And they couldn't have been further from the truth. Like, the colours were unbelievable. We were quite late in the season. We got back in April, so we were the last trip for the season. And I don't know if that made any difference as to, you know, the position of the sun in the sky, but it would be nothing to wake up and go up on deck and just see a brilliant yellow sky with a grey iceberg in front of it, and just this, you know, moody indigos, all the colours switching around, or like a strip of bright orange, you know, otherwise icy blue landscape where the sun was striking some ice cliffs off in the distance.
So how were you capturing? Were you trying to capture things at the time to remember the ideas? Or
I
just
took
soaking
heaps of
it in? Or?
Yeah, I didn't draw very much. But yeah, I was taking photos all the time, and they've been a wonderful reference to have all the time.
Did you see many animals?
Yeah, saw heaps of animals. Saw beautiful killer whales sometimes in the morning. And one morning, when you have an Antarctic Fellowship, you have to kind of have a project that you're doing. And my project, because I spend so much time working in schools around Australia, I came up with this idea called Kids Antarctic Art. So every night of my voyage, I emailed kids, ended up being kids around the world, describing what I was seeing, and I asked them to draw in response to what I was telling them, and they sent me their drawings. And when I got home, there were like huge piles of big fat envelopes full of drawings from kids all over the place. And I
you were going from description, so you were describing with words what you could see,
yeah,
and they were interpreting that into a drawing.
Yeah. And then I used their drawings to make an exhibition of 40 images called Kids Antarctic Art, which has travelled lots of places around Australia and some overseas places as well. And
I'm just trying to picture what you, because the, you know, that cliche about committees ask committee to design a horse and they give you a camel or something like that. Yep. I'm just wondering what the description that you sent out landed back that you weren't expecting.
There were all sorts of things like there were many, many drawings of the ship. And so often when I was doing a picture, if there were a lot of things, I'd photocopy them and chop them up and turn them into a collage. And one image that has been a really popular one, all these, they sell as limited edition prints. All the originals have been kept, but it's been lovely being able to sell them as big canvases and prints and all sorts of things. And all the profits that come out of that project go to the Royal Children's Hospital because it's not really mine and I could never track down all the kids to pay them back. But so, yeah, sometimes it would be a whole lot of kids making up a picture. But one image that I really, really love became a picture called Arnhem Land Penguin, and it was from a little girl from Gunbalanya, and it was about a centimetre and a half high, a drawing of an emperor penguin bending over looking at its chick. So I put that into the computer and just cleaned it up and printed it on watercolour paper, and now it has this really moody indigo background with white snow circling around it that have a kind of an image of the dot paintings as well, so it's a kind of a marriage of the two things.
What about the legacies of explorers when you travel to a region like that? Explorers like Douglas Mawson, like Ernest Shackleton. Did you find yourself connecting with a sense of human history while you were there?
Not so much on that trip, but I did another trip at the end of the year working as a photographer on a tourist boat, and we went down to the Ross Sea where Scott left from to go to the South Pole, and where Shackleton had a hut too, where he'd made an earlier attempt at the pole with Scott that they actually had enough sense to turn back and live through. And it was incredibly poignant going to those two huts. The Shackleton's hut is at Cape Royds, and when I stepped into that, there's an organisation called the New Zealand Heritage Huts, I think, who manage them. So they're managed quite carefully. Only a few people can go in at a time. But you can actually walk right in and just see everything there as it's been left. And to me, that hut just felt like they'd had a fabulous time there. There was a huge big cast iron stove and the sun was coming in the window and turning everything gold. And you can imagine the happy time they'd had. And when I stood in Scott's hut at Cape Evans, it felt terribly sad because I couldn't help remembering and imagining what it was like for those men in his party who had to stay on for a whole winter after he didn't come back. You know, they had to wait for that whole winter for the ship to come again. And it must have been terribly sad for them. They're living there knowing their friends had all perished. And it just felt terribly sad, yeah.
You're listening to The Guest Room right across the Territory. And with you today is Alison Lester, who's a children's author and an illustrator. She's written almost 30 books, including her bestsellers Clive Eats Alligators and Imagine. But Alison has spent a lot of time in heading to Antarctica as often as she can and also in remote Aboriginal communities in the Territory, including Gunbalanya in Arnhem Land, which led to her story, Ernie Dances to the Didgeridoo. We'll hear a little bit more about that a little bit later in the program. But Alison, another time you got a job on a Russian icebreaker.
Mm-hmm.
What are those? I can just imagine you ticking off the list. Okay, I can't go on the Aurora anymore. I can't go on any more tourist trips. All right, we're down to Russian icebreakers. What was that trip like?
Well, the Russian icebreaker actually was a tourist ship. And I think how a lot of the tourism to Antarctica began was that when the Soviet Union broke up, there was all these icebreakers that needed work. So then people saw the opportunity to commission them to go to Antarctica and also up into the Arctic. And the Captain Klebnikov is the name of the ship, and it's chartered by an American company called Quark, who I think they're about to lose the ship. I think this might be the last summer they're going down with it. But it was a fabulous ship to be on. Like, it was, after being on the Aurora Australis, which was fabulous, but a working ship, this was really luxurious, like, you know, pastries for morning tea and, you know, silver service dinners and all that sort of stuff. And they also went out of their way to take us to as many places as we could. So they had helicopters on the ship, so you would helicopter off and visit the huts and really just have an enormous experience. And it was fabulous having a Russian crew too, like the helicopter pilots and technicians were Russian and all the crew were Russian as well.
Well, it just added a bit of atmosphere.
Very good atmosphere, yeah. And then most
why,
of these,
why was that?
Oh, just hearing those fabulous Russian accents. But there was always... those tourist ships always have like a staff who do lectures because there's a lot of sea time. So there's a historian and, you know, a geologist and a glaciologist. And so there's always lectures where you just learn so much as you go along.
Did you strike any really, really bad weather?
We had a fabulous storm on that trip when we're on the Captain Kolebnikov, and it's an enormous ship. Like, you can not imagine being afraid at seeing it. But when we left Macquarie Island and we were heading down to Cape Adare in Antarctica, I can remember the weather getting bad and being up in the radio room and the guy showing me the weather map, and the bars were so close together it was almost black, like you could see there was some nasty stuff there. And what they'll often do when the seas are rough is they'll put the ship into an area where there's ice, and the ice acts like a blanket and calms the sea down. But I think there must have been a lot of pressure on the captain to get south because people had paid all this money and they wanted to go and see various things. So at one stage we're all told to, you know, hang on, because he was going into the sea. And I was lucky enough to be up on the top level with some of the other staff on the ship. And as he came out of the ice and into the sea, this enormous ship's nose was burying itself in waves, and pieces of ice as big as a Volkswagen were being washed onto the deck. And at the time I just thought it was fabulous and that they knew what they were doing, but later I heard that it was actually really, really dangerous. So the ship was going, the blocks of ice were washing on, and then as the ship swung from side to side, they were skidding across the deck and knocking out all the superstructure. And the really dangerous thing was that even though it was an icebreaker, it strengthened for ice from the outside, it wasn't strengthened for ice to be hitting it from inside. So there was a real danger that the bulkheads were going to be knocked out by one of these huge missiles skidding around. So
these Volkswagen
he quickly sized. Put it back into the ice, and we sat there for 3 days until the storm passed.
Yeah, that sounds like a more sensible option. What does being in that place do for you as an environmentalist? Did it change you?
It makes you it depresses me in a way, because I feel like there's so little hope that it will be able to stay that way. Like, I think there's going to be so much pressure on Antarctica in coming years. And the Antarctic Treaty is a beautiful thing and it's working at the moment. But as soon as a big nation wants to get in there and do something, I don't think it's going to hold up. I think there's going to be awful things happen in Antarctica, probably as people go down there, they're looking for minerals and gas. And I think it's got about the third biggest gas reserves in the world under it. So yeah, I feel very worried that it won't be able to keep the beauty that it has now. And I mean, now is an incredible time because all the countries have got in there and cleaned up their bases. I think McMurdo, for a while, the American base, looked terrible. And I mean, it still looks like a mining camp when you go to it. It's so big, but at least they're cleaning up all their rubbish and taking it away. But yeah, I don't know how long it's going to last.
And we heard your very surprising opener to the show, your choice of Prisoner of Society by the Living End to kind of kick us off. But I can't help but wonder what the soundtrack was for you when you were travelling.
I took my laptop with me and I had little speakers in my room and I had just all my music. So that was really what I was listening to, just all my stuff. I also shared my cabin with a fellow arts fellow whose name was Frances Evan, who was a musician, and she had a fiddle with her, and that was a really lovely thing to be up on deck with her sometime while she squeaked these beautiful tunes out of her instrument.
One of the songs that you're listening to a lot was Beck Runga, Sway.
I love this, yeah, I love this song. It always makes me think of Eddie, and I guess it's you're always thinking of your loved one when you play this song. True.
You are listening to The Guest Room right across the territory. Children's author and illustrator Alison Lester is with us. And Alison, I will get you to read Ernie Dances to the Didgeridoo in just a moment, but can you tell us what inspired this story first?
Well, it was really the kids at Goonpalanya who inspired it. I think I first went there in 1996 with Liz Honey, and the school wanted us to go there and make books with the kids and do murals and, like, really anything that could work on literacy. And I worked with the senior kids at the school, the senior primary, upper primary kids, and they made a beautiful book called We Love Goonpalanya. And I said to them at the time, I think we could turn this into one of the books in the Clovis Alligator series. So when I did it, I worked very closely with the school and also checked with the the community elders that it was okay. But the high school girls were my editors for this book. So it was before internet. I used to fax them up the text and they would read it and text me back all the changes or tell me what I'd got wrong. So I feel very happy that it was something that we all worked on together.
What sort of corrections would they make?
Well, one of the funny ones was there's a little picture where there's a girl walking across the floodplain taking a pig. It says, but Jenna goes for a walk and her grandfather's pig goes too. And when I wrote that, I said, but Jenna takes her grandfather's pig for a walk. And the girls wrote back to him and they said, we would never take the pig for a walk. We might go for a walk and the pig would come, but we wouldn't actually take him. So there were lots of changes like that that they got me to fix up just so that it was perfect.
Would you be able to read it for us?
I would love to. I haven't read it for ages. It's like visiting an old friend. It starts off, Ernie is going to live in Arnhem Land for a year. His parents are working at the hospital there. Ernie waves goodbye to Rosie, Frank, Tessa, Nikki, Clive and Celeste and promises to write them a letter for each of the six Arnhem Land seasons. He flies above the desert for hours and lands in Darwin. It's hot. He travels over the floodplains, crosses the East Alligator River and arrives at his new home. And you see him jumping out of the Land Cruiser with the sun going down over the billabong and fruit bats flying around and some kids and dogs looking at him from a tree. And it's that beautiful house that the manager always lives at the Arts Centre at Kumbalanya. Dear Clive, it's Gujuk now. Everyone will laugh at my bad pronunciations. I have to apologise for them. The monsoon season. It rains every day, but I'm having a good time. Sammy surfs in the puddles. He's standing on a fridge door. Christine slides in the mud. Ernie catches frogs. Joseph plays football. Patrick spears a barramundi. And Jenna rides her bike in the rain. But Tammy and her baby brother watch a goanna floating on the floodwaters. And I originally had a crocodile floating past the house, but the girls thought that was too ridiculous for words. Dear Frank, it's Bankerang harvest time. It has stopped raining and the sun shines every day. Christine plays Tintin. Sammy jumps into the waterfall. Ernie sneaks up on the buffalo. Patrick collects goose eggs. Joseph does backflips off the coconut tree. And Tammy gets chased by a crocodile. It's a crocodile that's protecting her eggs. But Jenna goes for a walk and her grandfather's pig goes too. Dear Nikki, it's Yeke now, cool weather time. The water lilies are flowering and they smell beautiful. Patrick gets painted with the crocodile dreaming. Joseph and his uncle collect bark for painting. Christine digs for yams. Ernie learns to make a spear. Jenna dances at the disco and Tammy goes for sugar bag. But Sammy is frightened by the Mimi stilt dancers. Dear Celeste, it's working, the early dry season. The grass is yellow and there are lots of mosquitoes. Tammy catches a file snake. Ernie goes fishing. Joseph takes his sister for a walk. Jenna's mother teaches her to weave pandanus. Sammy plays tin trucks and Christine learns the yam dance. But Patrick's grandfather tells him about the creation mother. And they're up on the up in Inyalak on the hill beside the town looking at the beautiful painting of the creation mother that I was happily given permission to do a copy of. Dear Rosie, Gurung is here, the hot dry season. There is hardly any water in the billabong. Jenna catches a crab at the beach. Patrick and his little sisters eat icy poles. Ernie collects green plums with old Daisy. Tammy digs up a long-necked turtle. Christine has her ears inspected. And Sammy's uncle tells him a dreamtime story about the moon. But Joseph surprises a thirsty horse under his house. Dear Tessa, it's Gurnamelang, the pre-monsoon season. It's very humid and there are thunderstorms every day. And here's a picture of the kids parading across the floodplain. Patrick is a horse in the school play. Tammy is a butterfly. Sammy is a frog. Ernie is a frill-neck lizard. Jenna is a corella. And Joseph is Ginga, the crocodile. But Christine rings the bell on Santa's truck. And now the kids from down south are writing back to Ernie. Dear Ernie, thank you for your letters. We are doing special Arnhem Land activities at school. Celeste is a stilt dancer. Clive wears body paint. Tessa teaches us some Gunwingu words. Nikki does a bark painting of her guinea pig. Rosie makes damper. And Frank is a hunter and his dog Roger is a dingo. But we wonder what you are doing, Ernie. And of course, Ernie is dancing to the didgeridoo and saying, Bobo.
Oh, it's beautiful.
Thank you.
It's and lovely to hear those corrections that the kids were making too about it. Was getting it right. Was it hard to sort of step into the headspace of the kids that you were hanging out with?
Oh, no, I loved working with them. And, of course, all the stories came from real stories they had when we were sitting down in the classroom saying, OK, let's make a book about this place. Like, what do you kids do? You know, what do you do as families? And the whole pig story, I can remember a little girl called Cheryl Lee putting her hand up just a little bit. She was very shy. And I said, what's your story, Cheryl Lee? And she had a very deep voice and she stood up and she said, when we go walking, if my grandfather's pig gets left behind, he cries. And all the kids laughed their heads off. So I knew we had to have that in there.
Oh dear, that's so funny. You could just take me there. You obviously do lots of workshops. Are the kids that you work with there different to kids that you work with in an urban environment?
Well, kids are kids, you know. Like the kids in communities are really a lot more switched on about the land and a lot more matter of fact about what you're going to eat and things like that. Whereas city kids, you know, if you mentioned, you know, killing a cat on Macquarie Island, it's like, killing a cat? My word, how could you kill a cat? So they're all different just because of their backgrounds. But I love working with kids because I always had, they have that bright-eyed, bushy-tailed way of, yep, what are we going to do? You know, it's wonderful seeing the potential in them that they, at that stage in their lives, they can do anything.
And what were you like as a kid, Alison Lester?
I was a funny little kid. I grew up on a farm that I thought was the world, you know, and I had a lot of responsibility early. Like, I worked hard on the farm doing cattle work. And so from when I was quite young, I could go and muster a mob of cattle and bring them back to the yards and work in the yards all day and do that sort of stuff. But I didn't have a lot of idea what went on outside that world. I mean, we weren't hillbillies, but I think I loved it so much. I was so into the animals that I struggled a little bit at high school, and I remember with great shame being a bit of a bully at primary school. Like, it's a terrible thing to admit. And I think it was probably because I was the youngest of four and I got bossed around. And then when I was at school, I took the opportunity to do it to other kids. And I remember, I couldn't even remember what I said to this girl, but I must have been picking on her. And she turned around to me one day and she said, why are you being so mean? My mum died last year. And that was the end of bullying for me. After that, I never, ever did it again. But I always feel really sorry for kids who do bully, but I always remember that I was one too, and it's hard to understand why kids do it, but, yeah, it's a terrible thing. So, yeah, I shouldn't have admitted that on radio.
Oh, but kids do mean things, and it's often, you know, this feeling that if that there is a space where you either go along with it or you, you know, it's hard to, you know, just socially, you know, it's socially scary sometimes at school. Yeah. You have to learn that you don't need to.
The things you have to learn, It's like kids mistreating animals often until someone says, you know, you think how that cat's feeling or what, you know, that you don't understand.
Did you grow up wanting to be a drover as a result of you only caring about what happened within the farm?
Absolutely. My best friend Bond's mother used to tell this story that she'd be out in the outback in the future and she'd see a mob of cattle and there'd be an old drover and she'd hop out of the car and go to meet them and there'd just be some twinkling blue eyes in a wrinkled old face and it would be old Leather Lester. But and I wanted to be a driver probably until I got to high school, and then I thought I'd like to be a vet. And then when I had to do chemistry in year 11, I thought, oh, this is going to be a bit hard too. So I really finished school with no idea what I wanted to do.
What did you do?
I went to uni just because I got a scholarship to go and just wasted it, like just went to the pub all the time and had a good time, failed half my subjects, which is another shameful thing to say, even though it was excellent fun at the time. But, pretty much a waste of a scholarship.
So where did this children's books thing come from?
Well, I guess our family has always been a family of storytellers. And when I finally got kicked out of uni, I signed up to do secondary arts and crafts and I trained as a high school art teacher. So I spent 4 years then doing all sorts of art, which I really loved, but very little teaching. And then when I went teaching, I found that pretty hard too. And in those days, you actually got, the government paid you a studentship to do your teacher training and you were supposed to teach for 3 years to pay it back. But in those days, which was sort of before feminism, if you're a girl and you got married, you only had to teach for a year. So Eddie and I got married on the strength of that and went to South America. And we're still married, so I guess it worked. And it wasn't until I came back and I was having my first baby.
So how long had you been going out at that stage?
Oh, we've been together for a long time. Like, it was, we sort of knew we were going to stay together, but we probably wouldn't have got married if I hadn't had to have got out of teaching. And when we came back and I was pregnant with my first baby, I knew that I wanted a job that I could do from home. And someone said to me, why don't you try and get some work illustrating kids' books? So I went out and had a very lucky interview and got a job, and it went on from there.
Can you describe your illustrative style?
My drawings are probably quite naive, I think. Like, I'm not very good at drawing things. I guess I have a kind of a shorthand of drawing, so my faces are always just two little dots and a nose and a mouth. And I've tried many times to draw proper faces with eyelashes and things like that, and they never work. But within that shorthand, I seem to be able to get enough of a range of expressions that it works. I guess what I like doing most with a pencil is just capturing a moment, especially with the way a kid or an animal will look. And sometimes it's just a fluke, and sometimes I really work hard at getting it. And I love drawing with pencil, so I'll often photocopy that pencil line onto watercolour paper, and then I always paint with watercolours. I love the transparency of them and the way you can get such lovely, light, beautiful colours. But I sometimes use other techniques too. Like, I'm just about to get going on a book that I've had written for ages, which is an ABC of Australian animals that I'm using stencils for, so it's nice using different techniques.
Where do the ideas come from about how to draw, you know, their kids and the animals in the stories?
Well, I guess I'm surrounded by kids and animals. Like, I've turned into a bit of a baby stalker. I'm really hanging out for grandchildren. So when I see babies, I'm always kind of just going a little bit close and looking at them and smiling wistfully. And I see so many kids with my work, and I'm surrounded by animals at home. So I just have all that stuff in my head. And so there's often when the kids were little, I would sometimes say, just sit there and put your leg, you know, that way, so I could kind of actually see how the body got together. But it's really just these years and years of drawing. Like, I've just been talking to kids this morning and showing them some of the drawings that I did as a kid, and even that I did in my 20s, that are not very good. Like, it's really just doing it all the time that has made me become a much more skillful artist.
And despite all that practice, you still got a complaint letter from a zoologist.
Yeah, that's right.
One time, is that true?
That was more to do with the research than anything else. Yeah.
What happened there?
I have a book called Imagine, which is where kids imagine all sorts of animal worlds. And in the jungle one there in South America, and I don't know if that was the one she was specifically talking about, but might have even been a joke, because she said, my name is Autumn Brown, and even though I have a degree in zoology, I cannot identify all of the animals in your book.
Oh, you've chosen some Elvis Costello for us this morning. Would you be able to introduce this song for us too?
Now, I'm trying to think which one it is. Oh, it's A Good Year for the Roses, isn't it? Yeah, I love this song. I actually fell in love first with the George Jones version of it, because it was on a compilation tape that we had, and we used to just play it over and over in the car. Really, really love it. But at least you thought you wanted it. That's so much more than I can say for me. What a good year for the roses. Many blooms still linger there. Elvis Costello, Good Year for the Roses, on ABC Local Radio across the Territory. You're listening to The Guest Room, and I'm joined by Alison Lester, children's author and illustrator. That song takes you to, as you said, you sort of fell in love with that song in particular, but it does take you to a trip with your son, Lockie. Yeah. We play that in the car all the time, but one time we were riding up, not on the high plains, but heading up that way past Omeo with a group of people, and someone's horse had got very, very ill. And horses can get this thing like type when they get too much lactic acid going on. And the horse had to be abandoned while everyone else rode on. And I said that I was going back to get it. So Lockie, who was about 14, and I set off after going a really long way to pick up the float in this terrible track to pick up the horse. And it was so steep that often when we were going up the hills, you couldn't see the track. You could just see the bonnet of the Land Cruiser. So it was fairly nerve-wracking, and it was getting dark anyway. We got into where the horse was.
With a float on the back as well.
With a float on the back, yeah. And and the horse was so pleased to see us, he almost leapt into the float, and we managed to head off out again. And Lockie wanted to drive, so he drove all the way out. And this was one of the songs that was playing, and I'd always remember
while your fingernails dug into.
I know he was being very good. Like, I was kind of exhausted, so I was happy just to sit and let him doing it. And it always reminds us of that time when we did this slightly heroic thing. Yeah.
How much have your kids inspired you in your work?
Very much. Like, it's them who see the world, you know, through various ways. In fact, Lockie's got a book of his own. He did a picture book at school called Clancy the Courageous Cow that came out a few years ago. And often kids will tell me that they love it. So that's really nice. And my oldest son...
When did he actually do it?
He did it in year seven at school with a lot of pushing from me. He was such a lazy kid at school, and I really had to push him to finally get something done. And when he did, like as often happens, he did something that was fabulous. And when I travel around to schools, kids always say, you know, where do you get your ideas from? So I used to take this funny little book he'd made and say, well, this is what Lockie did from his idea, and they loved it. So I showed it to my editor once. You know, it's a terrible story of someone, oh, here's my son's book, isn't it good? But she said, look, we wouldn't publish it, but I'll pass it on to someone else. And they wrote to Lockie and said, we'd love to publish your book. So he had to do all the art again. But it's, yeah, it's been a winner for him.
And he did his own illustrations?
Mm. He draws, when they wrote to him, they said, we love the way your cows look like demented aliens, because he's a really weird drawer. And I taught him how to use watercolours, so it's quite a nice combination, yeah.
And so how long after he'd written the first, that book, originally?
I think it probably came out when he was about 18, yeah. So it was and it's earned him lots of money. It's
not
been published.
Not many 18-year-olds are children's book authors.
No, and he's just finished his second one, so it's called Banjo Bounces Back, about a horse who gets fat and thin again.
And is that is there a particular sort of pride that happens when your kids follow in your footsteps in a way?
Oh, it's lovely that they do it. And I think, I mean, they don't think I work at all. They just think I goof off and have a great time all the time. So I think that's why they
think
making books. Well, no, I must do some work at some time. But it does feel like I have a pretty good time as well. But I think they all see that it's been such a lovely career for me. So Will, my oldest one, who's actually a vet, has written a big chunk of a novel that he hopes to have something happen to one day. And my daughter Claire is a trainee editor at Penguin. So they're all kind of in the biz in some way, which is nice.
There was Are We There Yet? Was the story of your family's trip around Australia. The title just makes me smile. Anyone who's been on a car trip with kids has heard that phrase from the back seat, haven't they?
Yeah.
And is that important, being able to reflect the reality as well as the imaginary world?
Oh, I think there's so much in my books that's real. Like, I don't actually make very much up, you know. I go off on little imaginary trips about things, but most of the stuff is true. And that book, Are We There Yet, nearly all of it's true. Like, Lockie really did say when I made him come to the ladies' toilet with me because he was a bit little to go to the men's, well, if anyone comes in, call me Kylie.
Oh, dear. What's the key on the other side? What's the key to getting kids interested in reading and interested in stories, do you think?
Mm.
Especially now.
I think it really is reading heaps to them from the word go, from even when they're babies, you know, reading books. So it's just something that they see that you really value and that is part of your life and that you can have such a good time with it. I think if all you read is magazines, it's pretty hard to get your kids to respect books. But I think, yeah, and when you read them from a very early age, it's not just the reading, it's all the cuddles and the time together that comes along with it.
And what then? If you read enough, then you can get your kids interested in being interested in books in the long term?
I think so. I don't think it's possible for it to happen the other way, that if you read to them all the time when they're little, I think they will become readers. There's probably someone out there going, that's rubbish.
And is it the same for encouraging creativity in kids, do you think? Because you work with kids all the time.
Yeah. Kids have this funny thing that I find all the time. Little kids up to about grade three, you know, say, draw a submarine, and they just do it. Like, they're so happy with it, and they're always happy with their result, and they don't dwell on the result. But once you get past that stage, kids are all kind of self-conscious and, oh, it's going to look terrible, and we're also afraid of being judged. So I'll often get them to not worry about their drawing too much, but use another kind of art overlay that will transform that drawing into something else, like turn it into a stencil or a monoprint, so there's something that disguises their bad drawing.
In a gentle sort of a way, in an encouraging sort of a way. You are in the territory this week, Alison Lester. Is it a buzz meeting your audience and seeing people's faces when they hear your stories?
It's always lovely talking to kids. Like, sometimes I'll get to a school feeling a bit like, can I tell this story one more time? But there'll be little kids out the front going, she's here, you know. And that's always so exciting. And I think I've got a lot of kid in me still. Like, I can remember very distinctly what it was like to be a little kid. And so I just am always so interested in them and what they're doing as well.
If you wanted to meet Alison Lester, she will be at the Darwin City and Casuarina Libraries tomorrow in the city at 10 o'clock in the morning, and at Casuarina at 1 o'clock for a Babes and Books session, and also at 6:30 for an author talk as well. Alison Lester, thank you so much for coming into the guest room today.
Thanks for having me, Kate. It's been lovely.
Could I get you finally just to introduce the last song that you've chosen for us?
I can't think what it
is. Houses on the Hill?
Oh, yeah, I love this song. This is Ryan, not Bryan Adams. And I'm not sure if he's with Whiskey Town, the band, when he does this, but it's a really beautiful song that my son and I, eldest son Will and I, really love this song, and we just know it back to front. And the other day we were talking about someone putting something up in the roof of a house, and Will said, "What were they looking for up there?" And I said, "Oh, maybe just a blanket or artifacts," which is a line from the song. And we both just looked at each other and went, "We got it."
There were stars in the sky. There were houses on the hill. And there were bottles of pills that were easy to buy. Keep her warm from the oncoming storm. Life found him in the northwest.
This has been the Northern Territory Guest Room. Listen live each weekday from 11 a.m. Territory time, or go to abc.net.au/Darwin or /Alice Springs to hear more.
If you've enjoyed the Guest Room, you might like to check out Tales from the Tinny as well, also available on podcast at abc.net.au/Tinny.